The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton and this is Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today, the FA sack another England manager, women's boss Mark Sampson goes, but not for the reason we all thought he might. And we discuss songs about Romelu Lukaku. Unfortunately, there's also been some football. Real Madrid's home record in the league is as bad as Spurs. They lose at home to Betis. You could call it the Bernabeu hoodoo. And the Carabao Cup. Have we stopped caring about people caring about whether anyone cares about the Carabao? Plus Feedback Corner, an amazing song about Spurs. Your questions, and that'll do for today's Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel. Hello, Andy Brassel, Football Oracle.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I hear on the way that you're no longer Trevor Nelson's neighbour.
This is big news.
I feel I've been brought here under false pretences, really.
He did record a little section for the pod. And I'm going to have to miss a pod in December, and I'm really hoping that he'll cover for me.
Yes.
Barry, your thoughts on that?
That would be very exciting.
Wouldn't it be good? Priya Ramesh, football writer with a Dutch speciality. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks for coming in. Barry, what is your speciality? Just checking.
Well, my speciality is bringing up the green Caribou cup box, and I just realised I left it downstairs on my desk. So I'm just going to dash up and get it.
Yeah, let's pause, and Barry will be back in a minute. Okay, then Mark Sampson was sacked yesterday by the FA for something none of us knew about until yesterday, or not many of us did. Completely different set of allegations to the allegations that we did all know about. It's complicated, and the story isn't finished yet. Martha Kellner is the Guardian's chief sports writer, was at the press conference, the FA's press conference yesterday. How are you, Martha?
Hello, not too bad, thank you.
So as concisely as you can, why was Mark Sampson sacked?
So I think it was obviously since these new allegations have been seen in their full detail by the FA chief executive Martin Glenn. These allegations relate to Sampson's time at Bristol Academy, where he first worked with a group of 10 to 16 year olds, and then worked with the Bristol Academy first team, who now play in the Women's Super League. And their allegations that actually first came to the FA's attention in March 2014. And they concern inappropriate relationships that Mark Sampson had with female players in that team at Bristol. They were investigated for a year. I think the investigation ended in March 2015, at which point the FA's safeguarding and investigations team cleared him to continue as England manager. Martin Glenn obviously came into his post in March 2015. It wasn't until October 2015 that Martin Glenn claims to have first become aware that this investigation even took place. And it wasn't until last week that Martin Glenn first saw the full details of this report. He says he was so shocked by the report that he immediately referred it to the FA chairman, Greg Clark, and together they came to the decision that Mark Sampson's contract should be terminated immediately. And we obviously found out all about this at a hastily convened press conference at Wembley yesterday.
I'm always loath to criticise the FA because it's such a wide-ranging organisation that does a lot of things and does a lot of things well, but it's impossible to look at this and not see it reflecting badly on them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the handling of it's been abysmal. I think there's certainly questions for the executives at the FA, both the ones who are in their position now, Martin Glenn and Greg Clark, who I think should have asked to see this report sooner, but also the previous regime, Sir Trevor Brooking, who was obviously he was in charge of recruitment at St George's Park when Mark Sampson was appointed. And I think there's questions about due diligence when employing England managers. You know, this is the second time in less than a year that an England manager has lost their job over misdemeanours off the field. Obviously, Sam Allardyce left, I think it's almost a year ago to the day, because he was caught on camera suggesting how to circumnavigate FA third-party ownership rules. So I think there's serious questions to be asked about whether there was a dereliction of duty and a duty of care that Martin Glenn had to that England women's team to make sure that there was an appropriate person in charge of that squad.
Martha, it seems very convenient for Martin Glen and Greg Clark that they've suddenly, out of nowhere, found a reason to sack Mark Sampson that they can blame on people who were there before them. Is that what the journalists at the hastily convened press conference were sort of thinking as well?
I think that's a very, very sort of fair reading of the situation. Mark Sampson's been hugely successful on the pitch with this England team. You know, he took them to a semi-final of a World Cup for the first time in 2015. They won the third-place playoff. You know, they went through to the semi-finals of Euro 2017, the summer just gone. So he has been enormously successful. And I think that may have clouded judgment on Mark Sampson up until recently, obviously, when Annie Aluko made her allegations of bullying, harassment and racism under Mark Sampson's regime. That sort of all happened this summer, first reported in the Daily Mail and then in The Guardian, who've obviously taken this story on. And I think Mark Sampson became a problem for the FA, and it does seem convenient, as you say, that all of a sudden this report from almost 2 years ago has suddenly come back to light.
Martha, where does this leave the current players? Of course, they celebrated one of the goals in the qualifier against Russia on Tuesday by going over to the bench and celebrating with the coach. I mean, is there a sense that maybe they've been a little bit used here?
I think so. I mean, I don't know whether you saw that. Well, you did see that celebration. It looked orchestrated to me. I don't know whether it was something Mark Sampson himself had suggested. I think that's probably unlikely. I think the team have probably decided that they were going to celebrate in that way. But yeah, I feel like maybe they have been hoodwinked and manipulated. And I found that very uncomfortable to watch, given the nature of the allegations made, not only by Annie Aluko, but by Drew Spence, a mixed race player, alleged that she'd, discriminatory comments had been made to her. These are serious allegations. I think Leanne Sanderson, another mixed race player, said that she felt discriminated against during Mark Sampson's time as England manager. And I felt uncomfortable watching another group of women celebrate in that way. I felt like it was disrespectful towards Annie Aluko and the other women. And I don't know whether they're in full possession of the facts. I presume they don't know the nature of the allegations made against Mark Sampson during his time at Bristol Academy, which were, by the FA's own admission, serious enough for him to lose his job in a matter of days after the full details came to light.
Martha, this is a story that's obviously moving very quickly and will probably have developed further by the time this pod has come out. Is there a danger that the investigation into the alleged racist remarks is going to be overshadowed by whatever revelations are inevitably going to come out of Sampson's time at Bristol? And if so, do you think that is what the FA are hoping will happen?
I think they probably are. I think the sort of the allegations during his time at Bristol Academy, I'm sure they're going to be pored over, particularly by the tabloid newspapers. I'm sure there's more salacious details to come about that, and I think it will detract inevitably from the Aluko allegations, which are, for some reason, they're seen as more trivial and not serious. And I hope that isn't allowed to happen, because I think there's been huge failings, as Danny Taylor in our papers pointed out time and again. The investigation into the Aluko allegations was not done properly. Catherine Newton, the QC who led that investigation, failed to interview many of the main protagonists. And there are serious questions to be asked about the Aluko allegations. She took part in this, what the FA called a culture review. I think in March 2016, she was asked to assess what the culture was like in the England setup, whether she had any concerns. She was promised that would remain completely anonymous. During that review process, she raised concerns about comments that Sampson had made to her, which she found to be racial remarks. A week later, Mark Sampson came to talk to her and said that she wouldn't be taking part in the upcoming England camp, and accused her of un-lioness behaviour. That smacks to me of a review which perhaps has not been, you know, has not remained anonymous. And I think there's definite questions to be asked of Martin Glenn about when these Luco allegations came to light, why he didn't ask to see the report into the safeguarding allegations made against Mark Sampson during his time at Bristol.
I was just wondering, given that Sampson has now been dismissed, do you think it might allow some of the other players present at that meeting where Drew Spence was apparently asked how many times she'd been arrested by Mark Sampson, do you think now those players might find it a bit easier to speak up given they're not actually, you know, speaking about their coach or in putting themselves at risk of losing their place potentially?
Yeah, I think we've sort of seen time and again in sporting organisations that it's very hard to come forward and stick your head above the parapet when you're criticising someone who's still in that organisation, who has control over your destiny. You know, Mark Sampson was determining whether these women appeared for England, whether they went to major tournaments. He was in control of their career. And it's very hard to come out and criticise him. So I think it may free up the players who were there. I think there were three other players in the room when Mark Sampson made comments to Drew Spence, a mixed race player. He said something along the lines of, "You've been arrested four times, haven't you?" Things that he didn't say to any other player in the room. Those women, as I understand, are yet to come forward. And I hope that they will, because I think it's important that whistleblowers like Emmy Luco and like Drew Spence are supported by people who have witnessed this, because I will think it will encourage people to come forward in the future, and that's important.
Martha, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Martha Kellner, the chief sports writer for The Guardian. From racism allegations to racism allegations, the Romelu Lukaku song, we were debating whether to read out the words, but in case you haven't heard it, here it is. Lukaku, he's a Belgian scoring genius with a 24-inch penis, scoring all the goals. He was an unused sub yesterday. There is footage of fans singing it as they left Old Trafford. It doesn't rhyme, for a start, and clearly no one would ever written this song if Lukaku was white. The FA contacted Manchester United, asked them to address the song, kick it out, contacted the Premier League club to express their concerns. Yesterday, Manchester United tweeted, "We remind fans of our commitment to ensuring Old Trafford remains inclusive for all. Action will be taken against any offensive behaviour." If we work from the benchmark that we all understand that racism is bad, right? And most people don't want to upset other people. What are your answers to the apologists who say people singing it aren't racist? What's wrong with it? It's a compliment. Have you asked Lukaku if he cares about it? There are worse forms of racism that we should be worrying about.
Well, the fact that there are worse forms of racism that we should be worried about is irrelevant. You know, one thing being worse than another doesn't make the other thing not bad or acceptable. And those people are wrong. I don't think this... You know, you say if we work from the benchmark that everyone thinks racism is bad and we don't want to upset him. You know, you can't really work from that benchmark, I've noticed. Just Marina wrote a great article on this very subject the other day, and some of the comments under it on Twitter, well, the comments section weren't opened on it in The Guardian for, you know, there's a pretty good reason for that, because you know what's going to happen. And the comments under her, the tweet in which she flagged it up, were just almost relentlessly depressing. So she points.
So how do you? Because the point is, we're sitting around the table, I presume, thinking there's no debate in this, whereas other people think there is one. How do you, not just on this subject, on sort of any subject, when you're trying to explain why something
is wrong,
or do you just not bother
having
a debate?
Interest in debating this with somebody who thinks it's okay? You know, that's.
I think it's interesting how people will excuse certain behaviours in terms of the context. Like, if you told someone that someone had said this, you know, the chant about Lukaku, and said it normally to a normal black person, they'd say, oh, that's racist, that's, you know, categorically bad. But then, because it's in a football context, because you're apparently complimenting him, it shouldn't excuse it, but that's what people kind of, you know, tend to go into. And I think, as Barry mentioned, there was a great line at the end of Marina Hyde's article, which said, prejudice masquerading as praise may appear superficially more appealing than prejudice without disguise, but only superficially. And I think that's it. Like, it doesn't change the fact that it is racist and it is, you know, based on a prejudice. And on a slightly unrelated note, but there are a lot of chants about Jews in the Netherlands with relation to Ajax fans. And I think a few years ago, one of the presidents of the Jewish, you know, association said that there is no doubt that this sort of behaviour spills out into actual society. Like, you can't just say that's just at football, because it does spill out into society. And racism is a big problem as it is. I mean, as a woman and a person of colour, my Twitter feed is constantly pretty colourful in terms of that. And it is, I think, a good sign that Manchester United, the PFA, Kick It Out, are actually taking a serious stand on it and not letting it kind of fester into a bigger movement.
I think the Ajax comparison's quite an interesting one, because the first thing it made me think of when you were doing your intro, Max, was Tottenham. And the thing they've had, and it's extraordinary, isn't it? When you get non-Jewish people coming out and saying, "Oh, it's okay." I mean, that's just an incredible thing to come out with, really, isn't it? And it is a problem that football has. Like Priya says, separating how you would behave in normal society and how you behave in the stadium, you know, it's beyond a suspension of disbelief, really, isn't it? I mean, they had a campaign in France a couple of years ago, some adverts on television saying, showing a series of scenes in everyday life where people were behaving like aggressively, quite aggressively. Like, for example, a man sort of doing like an offensive chant, for example, in the house to his wife, and it was putting them in these outside the stadium contexts. It says the payoff was, you wouldn't behave like this outside the stadium, so why would you behave like this in the stadium? It seems quite an obvious advertising campaign, but maybe not obvious enough for some.
I mean, we're not going to solve racism, you know, in this room. But how? Because, like you say, Barry, you can't be bothered to have that debate with someone who thinks it's okay, which is fine. But it just means, should we be trying to change people's minds? How do you go about doing that? Or do you just say, we've lost them, there's nothing we can do?
I don't think there's anything I personally can do. I mean, no, but we should obviously try to educate people. They are entitled to their opinion. I just couldn't disagree more with them, you know, and they probably think I'm a wet liberal snowflake. So I don't think we're ever going to agree on it. But, you know, whatever about the racism of the chant, and, you know, there are far more offensive things, as some people have argued, but it's just rubbish, you know.
This is deeply offensive and rubbish.
Just rubbish.
It puts Lukaku in a bit of a weird position, doesn't it? Because he maybe, if you're talking about changing things and changing the way that people look at things, maybe him coming out to say something would make a difference. But does he really want to come out and say something? You know, he's just at a new club. I'm not saying whether he should or shouldn't. I'm just saying, from his perspective, does he want to come out and say something and create an awkwardness with the supporters? Maybe he feels that it's not worth it.
I think that dilemma is pretty much, you know, something that anyone who's experienced racism has gone through. Do you actually confront the person and, you know, put yourself through the trouble of explaining your side to them? But if you break it down, like, at one level, someone experiencing racism telling someone who's like abusing them in that way is them telling them that, as a human, I am equal to someone else, and that you would assume that is like basic knowledge. It's something we see in the Ennio Luco cases as well, in terms of, you know, how stereotypes should not be propagated, and that really is the essence of it, is the fact that you can't profile an individual based on a race or what you assume a race generally behaves like. That is just fundamentally wrong, and I mean, for me, that is the end of the discussion. It's just not right.
It's a good place to end the discussion. If you want to read more, Marina Hyde was great Ram has asked a question.
I just hope it makes you think twice next time on live national radio. Yeah. You start going on about me waving a knobbly stick, carrying a pig around under my arm.
No,
I find that very offensive and hurtful. And particularly when you go on about surveys to see whether I should be sent back to where I came from. Has it occurred to you that perhaps I'm too intimidated to blow the whistle in case I lose my place on the team?
Listen,
Max.
If there was an HR department at TalkSport, look, good luck when you go there. Ram says, does the League Cup have any relevance anymore, brackets, apart from Barry's Carabao button, of course? Carabao! Does the League Cup have any relevance anymore, Andy Brassel?
I think it does, because I think, especially in an era when it's so expensive to get into football matches, it gives young fans the opportunity to go. Maybe there's a bit of an age limit this week when it's midweek and it's not half term. But for the next round, I think it certainly makes a difference. And what is like a tenner to get into Arsenal and a fiver for kids. Same with Spurs at Wembley. So I realised that, you know, better pricing or more competitive pricing overall would be a preferable situation. But I do think
it's a trophy, isn't it? I mean, we always forget. I mean, we've had this conversation a million times and everyone has had the conversation, but you could only win four things potentially.
I think that people look at it in the same way as a lot of people look at the Champions League. In the early rounds, they don't really care. But when it gets to the thick end of it, yeah, it's important.
Mm. I think it's important that if you take the case of Mourinho, he always seems to have a certain liking for the League Cup, and I think that is because it is kind of the first trophy that you can win in a season. Mm. And if your side is also competing in the Premier League or the Champions League, it kind of gives you a good momentum to build on. That, you know, we've won something, so we just go and build on that. We add to the trophy cabinet instead of having the pressure of if we don't win this, we're going to be trophyless for the season.
Marcus Rashford got a brace for Manchester United. They won 4-1 over Burton. Chelsea put 5 past Forest. Hat-trick for Batshuayi. Johnny says, could Batshuayi ever challenge Morata to start for Chelsea? Andy?
I think it's difficult to imagine. But then again, they're coming from a sort of similar place, aren't they? Where they're not habitual starters at their clubs. I mean, Morata had to do that. He had to battle through in the same way that the Batshuayi had to do at Marseille. I mean, if we go back to where he started at Marseille, for example, he started 5 games in his first season, 5 league games in his first season under Bielsa, and he almost sort of stereotyped himself as an off the bench impact sub in that time. And it's something that I guess he's struggled to grow out of in his senior career. But I do think he's better competition for Morata than some of the players in the past. You know, Morata has shown as well that he's fine with being given a little rest. I think as well, if you look at Morata, who started the season brilliantly in his first season in English football, I think it's really optimistic to imagine that he's going to start, even if he remains fit, for every one of 60 games. But that's why he will get his chances, and he deserves to.
Well done to Bristol City, beat Stoke and Leeds, who put out Burnley on penalties. Man City won 2-1 at West Brom. Gundogan was scythed down by Jakub, which
was a pretty horrible one.
One from behind, yeah. And given what he's been through, hopefully be okay. I think Pep's playing down how badly injured he was. Arsenal scraped past Doncaster. Everton beat Sunderland 3-0. 2 for Calvert-Lewin, 1 for Nias. Paul says, is Umar Nias a golden boot contender? Nice touch that Everton had the Bradley Lowry Foundation on their shirts for that game against Sunderland. And while we praise them for that, we did forget to mention on Monday the Angry Birds logo that Everton had. Somebody asked on Twitter, is that a new low for sort of football sponsorship?
I mean, just in terms of an Everton shirt having a red bird on it is odd.
it's not really what they want to have there.
Yeah, I'd imagine not.
The Wayne Rooney verdict as well came in just after we finished on Monday. The fine is going to go to Everton in the community projects, which is a good thing. What would we like to see Wayne Rooney doing with his community service, Barry?
I don't know. I mean, I presume usual community services, cleaning graffiti and picking up litter and tidying grass verges and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Joey Barton did cleaned up litter at Newcastle Falcons when he was at Newcastle, but I don't know if it was after everyone had left.
Right.
You know, sort of when.
But I wonder if, like, you say you have a particular talent like Wayne Rooney has for playing football, if he might just be sent to coach kids or something, which yeah. I'm sure is some, you know, wouldn't be too much of an ordeal for him. He'd possibly quite enjoy it.
Priya, while you're an expert on Dutch football,
some say so.
And look, we're discussing Everton. Koeman's under a bit of pressure here. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, they haven't had the easiest of starts. So, like, if you think about the game against United and, you know, Chelsea, you wouldn't expect Everton to win those games. So I think it's fair that they've gone on to lose that. But the important thing that I noted was it's not just the fact that they lost that. It's the fact that there was a certain gulf in quality that remained. And for all that they've spent over the summer, you'd expect that gap would have closed to a certain degree by now. I was just kind of looking through some you know, records of Koeman, and his best seasons in club football as a manager have always come when he's had a striker who he can depend on for maybe 20-ish goals a season. So at Vitesse, he had Pierre van Hooijdonk. Ajax, he had Zlatan Ibrahimovic. PSV had Farfan, but that was a kind of very weird, lucky season for PSV. At Feyenoord and Southampton, he had Graziano Pella. And last season, he had Lukaku. So, and this season, I mean, Sandro looks good, but hasn't really inspired confidence, I think, for me, to say he'd score 20 a season. And it's just interesting to see that Koeman's sides are always so kind of centred on a striker in attack, and the fact that they've missed out on one for all their spending is just a bit puzzling for me.
I think it's weird how, in an era where I think we're all pretty much agreed that does money really mean anything in terms of transfer fees in the Premier League, that his success or lack thereof to this point in the season is judged on what he spent. Why would you judge anyone in the Premier League on what they've spent? Don't you judge them on the players they've got, and they're quite clearly short?
I think it's an important kind of point of discussion in recent times as well, because most clubs now have a director of football or a sporting director that handles the spending. So it's not like at Man United where Sir Alex kind of handled everything. So do we really attribute spending to the managers? I mean, yeah. Is it really justified to say Pep Guardiola spent, you know, 200 million when it's actually, you know, the people higher up at City who handle the recruitment side?
You think
of it.
That's like a hangover from when managers were managers?
Yeah.
But Everton, like, they've a couple of good kids coming through who are sort of in or on the fringes of the first team. They did seem to be buying someone new every week during the summer. So it seems, and they're all quite good quality players, and yet they don't seem to be the sum of their parts yet, and it's still early.
It's hard to play Sorry, Barry.
It does seem odd that Andy's saying they've come up short when, you know, just in volume of players.
They've got a lot of players.
Variety's not there, really, is it?
Yeah.
They've got a lot of players who are good behind a centre-forward. Mm.
And
a lot of them.
I think if you look at the profile of players like Sigurdsson had his best season at Swansea when he had Wilfred Bonny up top. And Davy Klaassen as well. Davy Klaassen works best when he has some pace down the wings and he can then run on to the cutbacks, and that's generally how he scored his goals at Ajax. So the profile of the players they've bought doesn't really kind of work with the squad unless they play someone like Calvert-Lewin, who was very impressive against City. And I think if you have that kind of variety in terms of having someone who can dribble, having someone who can, you know, add pace to the side, instead of just, you know, I was just really disappointed to see, was it all of Rooney, Sigurdsson and Klaassen that started one of the games? That was just a very, very puzzling selection there, because they're really not offering a lot in terms of, you know, depth of style.
Liverpool.
Sorry, Priya, you mentioned Pierre van Hooijdonk there earlier, which is a fantastic blast from the past. Do you happen to know what he's at these days? I have this image of him and Winston Bogart living in a house together, just sitting on the porch,
with
smoking, and sipping beer, and just laughing.
Winston Bogart is actually he's an assistant coach for the Ajax reserves, if I'm not wrong, at Young Ajax. Pierre van Hooijdonk, well, his most recent role was an ambassador for the Euros that just happened in the Netherlands. And it was pretty nice when Jackie Ronan, who was one of the stand-up players of the tournament for me, tweeted a picture after the finals that said, when you get to meet your heroes, and it was a picture of her and van Hooijdonk. And I thought that was very interesting in terms of maybe it's van Hooijdonk getting to meet his hero in Jackie Cronin.
Liverpool is the other sort of big story. They lost to Leicester. They can't defend. Moz says, is Jurgen Klopp, has he been found out? Is he under threat for the sack? I don't believe this, he says, but I've seen others who think it. And Peter Dobson says, is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain cursed? Someone has done that really nasty thing of editing every mistake Oxlade-Chamberlain made into 1 minute 57. I mean, you can do it with any performance of any player in any game, but it is really sad, especially when he just did a crossfield pass out of play. Anyway, that was Liverpool. Palace finally won. Well done, Roy Hodgson. While we're on Palace, do you want to do a Dutch bit on De Boer, Priya?
Well, I mean, De Boer did also win in the League Cup, if I'm not wrong, so I'm not sure there's too much credit to Roy there. Well, the thing that puzzled me about De Boer is that when they decided to sack him, the reasons that they seem to give for the sacking are all things that you could have found out if you kind of dug a little deeper into his time at Ajax. I mean, even the very small details, like playing Scott Dan up top when he was devoid of other options. He's done that before with Mike van der Hoorn, and not just like in league games, he's done that in the Champions League in like crucial matches. So
you'd think the English would laud that, wouldn't you?
Oh, Paul Warhurst.
Exactly. I mean, they're saying he's not adapting, for goodness sakes.
No, but I mean, the kind of, you know, horizontal style of passing, not a lot of pace going, not great in attack, all things that surfaced at Ajax in his last two seasons. And the thing that kind of, you know, interested me was if they actually went through quite a big process, Palace, in hiring De Boer. So did De Boer like sell himself that well in the interviews that they managed to give him the job? But then if they believed in him so much that they gave him the job, why sack him after four matches? Like, is that all the confidence that he inspired after that?
Well, he's really ghastly at picking jobs. I think we can say that much about him, because, you know, he walked into something that he was never going to come out of well at Inter. You know, I think Mancini left 13 days before the start of the season, and so he was lumbered with a difficult situation there. And then an even more difficult situation at Palace. Interestingly,
unless you're just after the payoff, you know.
Oh, yeah, you've hit on it, like, haven't you?
I've said it many times before, but I thoroughly hope, you know, to perform so badly at a job someone pays millions of pounds to go away.
Yeah, Ranieri, Villas-Boas.
You're halfway there.
Off that kind of stuff.
Just need to negotiate the settlement.
Hey, look, sorry, did you have an important point to finish there?
Not really, but I was going to say the shortlist for the Anderlecht job, they've sacked their coach, René Weiler, this week. Claude Puel, Frank de Boer are on it as well. It's a real sort of haven of Premier League refugees.
There's a really funny thing during the week where I think Frank de Boer's daughter is going to study in Cambridge for 6 months, and he basically posted on Instagram, and one of the hashtags was longer than her daddy.
Right, look, that'll do for part one, quite a long one, so thanks for sticking with it. We'll be back with Sid in part two. Welcome back to part two of Football Weekly Extra. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe is there. All right, Sid.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. I'm going to call it a crisis at Real Madrid now, officially. I handed the crisis from Barcelona to Real on Monday. Am I allowed to do that now they've lost at home?
I think you're allowed to do it. I mean, I think there's lots of different ways of analysing it, but I think certainly you're maybe not crisis, but they're in a pretty difficult position. I mean, you know, 7 points down on Barcelona when we're talking about a league where, you know, the totals have been over 90 points for the title winners, I think, for each of the last 8 or 9 years. And so 7 points is a long way to claw it back. It's still very early, of course, it's only 5 weeks. But you know, this is the sign that it's not quite working now. They've pointed at the mistakes, they've pointed at missed chances, maybe even some refereeing decisions as well. But, for example, last night, 27 shots we've had, and I think actually I was just looking at stats a minute ago. I think it is 27 as well. There've been 25 or so against Levante. I think it'd been about 25 against Valencia as well. But actually, although there were a couple of really, really good saves, it wasn't a kind of a constant flow of really good chances, which Real Madrid would have expected. And then they got caught at the end, and they didn't get caught in the way that you might expect to get caught late in the game, where, you know, everyone's bombing forward and it's just a long ball over the top. It's actually a minute and a half move. I think it's 22 passes. Betis pick their way through them and score a really, really nice goal. And it's the first time in 73 games that Real Madrid haven't scored. And I think that will worry them. But it's not just that. But it's that they, you know, they only got one against Levante. They got two against Valencia, should have got more. There is a lack of efficiency in their finishing at the moment. But I think it's more about the play. I think it's they're not creating the kind of clarity of chances that they probably would expect to.
But you presume they'll turn it around, whether enough to... It's interesting, isn't it? You say, because the points totals are so high, you know, are there people there that are writing them off from the title yet or not?
No, not to that extent. I mean, not least because, bear in mind as well, you know, it's a 7-point lead that Barcelona have got, and Barca have won every game so far. But there's still a little bit about Barcelona that doesn't entirely convince. I think there's still a belief that they will drop points, and perhaps more than in previous seasons, although obviously, you know, the more they kind of reinforce this run, the more they'll start to feel comfortable and be able to kind of, you know, get all the pieces in place. Although they're going to be without Dembele until more or less until, in fact, beyond Christmas probably. So I think there is a sense that Barcelona will drop points. There's a sense that Real Madrid will start finishing off some of these chances they're having. Even though, as I say, I don't think it's quite as clear cut as they would like it to be. There's one or two gaps in the squad. The number nine position, which I think we were talking about the other day as well, is perhaps problematic for them. Benzema's going to still be out for a while. Bale actually played okay last night, but you know, he's still kind of trying to find his place within the team. So there's definitely some genuine concern with this from Real Madrid. But as I say, there's also that sense of, well, it just kind of happens. And Zidane's argument last night was that this is football, you've got to accept it.
We were talking on Monday about some very bad teams in Italy. Alaves and Malaga have got one goal and 0 points between them. Are they as bad as that looks?
Yes. Yeah, they are. I mean, maybe Malaga aren't. In the sense you watch them play and, you know, even this week, I know it sounds ridiculous, they got beaten 5-0 by Valencia, but they're actually pretty good in the first half. They certainly competed. They had probably as many chances, maybe even better chances. There's been a couple of other games where you thought, yeah, they're not so bad, really. But there's a problem there in that they got rid of some of their better players in the summer. That's created a huge amount of tension between the owner, Altani, who does everything that he does through Twitter and basically... well, put bluntly, he says extremely stupid things extremely often on Twitter, which doesn't help the relationship with the coach, who's a coach although his kind of exterior persona is very calm and very cool, doesn't like being told what to do, doesn't like having his best players taken off him, and that tension, I think, if results don't pick up soon, will grow, and it's a surprise to me, to be honest, talking to you, what is it, nearly 12:30, that he hasn't been sacked yet. Alaves have already sacked their manager. Again, they lost their best players in the summer. They lost them in every line of the pitch, their best forward, their best central defender, their best central midfielder as well. They've also been a little bit unlucky. You know, the first game of the season is against Leganés. The captain misses a penalty, which maybe changes that. They could have picked up... I mean, they could realistically be on maybe 5-6 points at this stage and it wouldn't look so awful. But yeah, they do have genuine structural problems, and those two are early candidates to go down. I suspect Malaga will pull out of it. I'm not so sure about Alaves.
Sid, I wanted to ask you about the midweek game between Sevilla and Las Palmas. Of course, it was one of the weirdest transfers of the summer with Vitolo rejecting that extension at Sevilla and going off to sign for Atletico and going on loan to Las Palmas for the last 6 months. Tell us a bit about the reception he got there, and also about the fact that you talked about Real Madrid not having the amount of points that they thought they would. Well, Sevilla, despite not really having played that well so far, are way ahead of the eight ball.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. There's been little glimpses from Sevilla, but they still don't look that great. And there was certainly early in the season, there was I think a little bit of concern that things weren't quite falling into place, but the results have been good. The Vitolo thing, as you say, is bizarre. I mean, Vitolo, on the day that Sevilla announced that he's going to renew with them, and obviously this has been going backwards and forwards all summer. There was a very clear sense that he was going to go to Atletico Madrid, and then Sevilla announced it. The next day, he's turning up at the league, paying his buyout clause and going to Las Palmas. Now, what happened between Sevilla announcing it and the next day was a whole series of telephone conversations. The absolute fury of Diego Simeone basically saying to Atletico Madrid, this is a player I want, go and get him. Obviously, then they come back with much more money. Las Palmas also set to lose a lot of face because they were going to have him for the first 6 months, and their president pushed very, very hard. And in the end, they kind of effectively called him back in and said, right, this is the money, this is what we're going to do, let's do this. And he said, okay, I'll do it. And that, of course, has left Sevilla absolutely furious. They say they're going to take legal action against Las Palmas, against Vitolo, and against Atletico Madrid. And for the time being, he's playing for Las Palmas. He was there last night, lots and lots of chants against him. Traitor was written on the side of the team bus. It was maybe perhaps not quite as bad as we thought it would be, but still pretty bad. And, you know, he wasn't able to help his team who lost 1-0. But the big thing about it, of course, is that he's going to have to do this all over again, because the way the fixture list has fallen means that he goes there with Las Palmas in the first half of the season, and he'll go back with Atletico Madrid in the second half of the season.
Hey, Sid, some of the millions of our new listeners might not know of your sort of links to Oviedo. I got tweeted a picture of you on the pitch getting a standing ovation. What was going on?
Yeah, it's the local fiestas in Oviedo at the moment, San Mateo, and I was there for the fiestas as kind of, how do I explain this? It doesn't really exist in England. It's kind of part of the process of opening the fiestas. I did kind of the opening speech, if you like, to open the fiestas, and off the back of that, Oviedo invited me to be on the pitch on Sunday.
Do you do other openings of events? And
supermarket.
And boats, launching boats?
Christmas lights, yeah. Expect to see me on Wood Green High Road at Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I'd pay for that. Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain. Barry, Italy.
Yes.
Have you done any research? Watch all the games?
Well, I think all you need to know about Italy, the midweek round of fixtures, just dig out, if you haven't seen it already, Dries Mertens' goal for Napoli. It's just a thing of remarkable beauty, a sort of a deft, would you call it a chip?
It's sort of
near the touchline, which just perfectly judged to beat the goalkeeper.
Well, the keeper's come out, hasn't he? Mm. And he's sort of had a little challenge.
It's a very unpromising angle, as well. I mean, you think if he gets a good cross off here, he's done well.
Yeah, but then he sort of had to swivel on a sixpence. It was great.
They were brilliant, actually, Napoli. And that was a really tough game away.
Hey, this is Barry's Italy roundup, Andy. You've got Germany in a minute.
All right.
And you, Priya. You've got Holland. Carry on, Barry.
Well, Napoli beat Lazio 4-1. And Andy is quick to slap Napoli on the back. But I would point out, in Lazio's defence, they did lose three defenders to injury. And then were reduced to 10 men when a fourth player got injured. So their manager actually said their performance was excellent and that you can't really legislate for that kind of thing. And he's quite concerned about how they'll fare until the next international break, because these players are going to be sidelined and he's low on numbers. Elsewhere, Benevento lost again 4-0 at home to Roma. Again, this time their manager hasn't been sacked yet, but it does look like the jig could be up for him pretty quick. And Juve beat Fiorentina. And Inter dropped points for the first time this season. They drew away to Bologna.
Thank
and
you, Barry.
Oh. The Genoa coach looks like he might be getting sacked pretty soon. Ivan Juric, he's been given two games to save his job. And the next one is against Inter, so he's getting a free swing at that one. And after that, they play Bologna. If they don't win, he will be out the door.
Okay.
Sorry, just to Dries Mertens scored 34 goals in Serie A in his last 40 games, I think, since the start of last season. And actually, the goal against Lazio, Mertens gets compared to Diego Maradona, and he doesn't like it himself. But Maradona also scored a pretty similar lob versus Lazio in 1984, I think. So interesting piece of trivia there.
But if you he weren't born to... in 1984, how do you know this?
There's a magnificent invention called YouTube.
Nah, don't know what you're talking about.
If he doesn't want to get compared to Diego Maradona, he should perhaps stop being so bloody good.
No, but it's weird.
That's how you did it, Val, isn't it?
It's weird that he's so good and he's still so underrated. Because I think the Financial Times did a graph, I think end of last season, where they compared the most prolific players against the players who are most influential for their club, so scored the bulk of the goals and assists for their club. And it's not even Messi, Ronaldo, none of them. The only one that is like really high in both of these metrics is Dries Mertens. And you don't like, he's not the first name that comes to mind when you think of the best players in the world, but he is up there.
Crouchy say that actually, because anytime anyone mentions Mertens in my company, the first sportsman that springs to mind is the former All Black out half, Andrew Mertens. And then they're talking about Dries. So that's how underrated he is.
Yeah, you know, most people, though, would consider it sacrilege to compare anyone with Maradona. I think that's the second or third time that week that I've heard someone compared to Maradona. Simon Curtis wrote something, a very good article, actually, on ESPN, talking about the wonder of Sergio Aguero. And comparing him in certain ways to Diego Maradona, I always tend to give that a big swerve. But, you know, do what you want.
Germany, Andy.
I'm waiting for Barry, seeing as I encroached Barry's on his Italy roundup.
Barry's done now. He's having a rest. It's time for the German news with Andy Brassel.
I was at Schalke versus Bayern Munich on Tuesday, and there were a few little twitches around Bayern, because of course there was the news that Manuel Neuer broke his foot again in training on Monday, which means he'll be out till January at least. It took him 4 months to come back from his last broken foot, and he only just came back in August. And the other concern, in fact, is there's a huge drop off between him and the reserve, Sven Ulreich. And Ulreich looked a little bit nervy in the early stages. He got to make a few cosmetic saves later because James Rodriguez grabbed the game by the scruff of the neck, which is something I've written about in my Bundesliga column today. He was brilliant. It was his first start in the Bundesliga for Bayern. And Ancelotti said afterwards, well, you know, he's not 100% fit. Well, he's going to be pretty fantastic when he is 100% fit.
Wasn't there the famous stat last season, I think, that if Manuel Neuer hadn't actually played, Bayern Munich had conceded so few shots on target
the shots on target, they still would have won the league. Yeah, that's pretty fantastic, isn't it?
So it doesn't really matter who's in goal. Stick.
Well, you're assuming they're as good this season as they are last season. I think that's a bit of an assumption as things go at the moment.
I've just written it was Ulreich on the night. You want puns? Damn it, you've got them. Sorry, carry on.
I think you're going to get a job with Bayern's Twitter feed, because they were doing similar puns in German to celebrate his clean sheet. He was the first out in the mix zone afterwards. He was the first player out, pushed in front of the cameras as well, as if to say, everything's all right. Manuel may not be here, but everything is all right. Of course, they're going to have tougher tests than this, and Schalke are very, very good at self-sabotage, and they managed to do that in the first half by conceding 2 goals in 5 minutes. But yeah, James was pretty spectacular. And I was saying in the piece, actually, I kind of wonder if he's the player who's going to finally let Ancelotti put his personality on Bayern, because everyone's just been complaining so much since Ancelotti arrived that the intensity is not the same as it was under Pep Guardiola. But there was a bit of intensity to it. And James, who of course was Ancelotti's pick, we talked about sporting directors before sometimes picking the players. Well, Ancelotti said, I want this guy, go out and get him. And a lot of people thought, well, he's weird. Where does he fit? They've got so many other people who can play number 10. Well, he put a very, very convincing case forward. You know, he won the penalty for the first goal. He scored the second one. And he set up the third one with a brilliant pass for Arturo Vidal. He could have had a few more as well. So it'll be interesting to see, is this the point where Ancelotti's own attacking style starts to really bite at Bayern?
Let's go to Holland. Priya.
Just to add on to that, maybe it comes to Holland as well, but Peter Bosz became the first manager to keep a clean sheet in his first 5 Bundesliga matches in the history of the Bundesliga. And you think of Peter Bosz, and he's not a coach renowned for defensive work, so, I mean, props to him for getting to a good start at Dortmund.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if I'm too old to say props to him. you know.
I've got kudos.
You know, we're in the kudos generation.
Warm congratulation.
Yeah, well done to you.
A tip of the hat.
So I take my monocle off and bow to you. What's going on in the Eredivisie?
So at the top of the table, you have three teams tied on 12 points with identical records. Four wins and one loss, all of Feyenoord, PSV and AZ Alkmaar. Feyenoord lost last weekend to PSV 1-0, and the scorer was Gaston Pereiro, scored 2 minutes in, and he scored and scored or assisted six goals versus Feyenoord and Ajax for PSV, which is, you know, really puts him out there as a kind of big game player. And he's been interesting because he's usually a winger and he's played more in midfield this season. AZ won 2-0 at Sparta, and they kind of keep up with Feyenoord and PSV as well. They've got a very exciting team, especially Iranian winger Alireza Yahanbakhsh. He's very good. And Heerenveen are just below them in fourth on 11 points and still the only unbeaten team in the league. Martin Odegaard, who we might know from Real Madrid, is on loan at Heerenveen. But the one that's stealing the headlines for them is a 17-year-old centre-back called Kik Pieri. He's been great, and Ajax are sitting in sixth, having drawn at the weekend at Den Haag on their artificial turf. Klaas-Jan Huntelaar started ahead of Kasper Dolberg, despite Marcel Kaiser saying Dolberg was still his number one striker. And Huntelaar's earned himself a call back to the Dutch preliminary squad for the World Cup qualifiers. He also gave a great interview in Football International during the week on, you know, how he feels like a little boy again, being back playing for Ajax. He actually lived in Holland when he was playing for Schalke. So every time he went to training, he literally had to cross the border to get into Germany.
Of course, the travel costs wouldn't have really mattered because he was being paid such an obscene amount of money
true.
At Schalke.
That is true. I feel like no one has quite kind of earned as big a new contract with more money as much as Huntelaar, based on that one season where he was just kind of. Every touch was a goal.
Can I ask you about Odegaard, actually? You mentioned him before, but he's caught my eye a little for Heerenveen this season because, I mean, he's looked quite impressive. And, you know, there's been so little talk about his actual football since he signed for Real Madrid. But it looks like Madrid might even give him a new contract now.
I mean, there is a caveat of you know, the Eredivisie being a kind of weird league to scout attackers in. It's really weird. The defenders in the Eredivisie seem to do so well. We talked about Davinson Sanchez, and he's fitted into to Spurs without an issue. But then you look at Vincent Janssen, and you know, it's weird because these are the attackers that the defenders play against, and there's something that goes on there. But Odegaard has been decent. I wouldn't say he's a standout performer because Heerenveen have another winger on the other wing called Arber Zeneli. Very, very good. Very good at dribbling down the wing and getting the ball into very dangerous positions. I think Odegaard is doing a lot better. Started the season a lot better than he did back in January when he first arrived from Real Madrid. And I think he will kind of grow into it. And I think possibly the other interesting thing is that Real have also loaned Mink Peters, who was he played at PSV and Ajax, and then he went to Real Madrid, and he's been loaned back to FIFA Fenlo now, and he's not playing there. He's effectively like fourth choice for the wings. It's interesting in terms of Real turning to the Netherlands to, you know, farm their young talents.
Right, Priya, thank you. That was Holland. We'll be back in part three, which will begin with Fitbar Corner. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Fitbar Corner, Barry.
Yes.
Rangers play Celtic at the weekend.
Yeah.
It's a big one.
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, it's the big one for obvious reasons, but they played each other six times last season. Celtic won on five occasions. There was one draw. Celtic put five past them on two occasions last season. So it's difficult to see Rangers getting anything from this game. And even if they do, Celtic are still going to win the league, pulling a cart. But it's at Ibrox. Who knows what might happen. In another interesting, well, kind of interesting, and at the same time incredibly boring development, by the time this pod is out for public consumption, the whole Rangers EBT investigation issue is almost certainly going to have been put to bed, and everyone in Scotland can get on with their lives and stop complaining about the Rangers tax avoidance stuff that got them in so much trouble.
Okay. Thanks for Fitbar Corner.
It was short and sweet, wasn't
it? Well, that's how we like it. In the Premier League, the early kickoff is West Ham Spurs. Obviously, Spurs lost that game at the end of last season, which sort of paid to their title hopes. But more importantly, have we all seen the Spurs song that is doing the rounds on social? I know, because I played it all to you before this. Do you want me to play you a little bit?
Well, yeah, I've watched the video several times already.
I can't stop watching the video. Just if you haven't seen it, you'll go onto my Twitter feed and see it. But if you have a listen.
I think to get the full goodness of this video, people need to see it. The song doesn't quite do it justice.
So there's a baby that's not a baby, it's a doll. There's a line about bundling in box 99. So there's sort of quite gentrified, you know, fans in a private box. And the whole thing is totally baffling. And it's...
Well, producer Mel is reliably informed that this is a video some man commissioned his friends to do for his son's bar mitzvah.
Yeah, and they got into White Hart Lane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's bizarre. The whole thing is... Honestly, I literally can't stop watching it.
But in the course of the discussion about
yeah,
the bar mitzvah
I know where
thing,
this is going.
It emerged. And I can't stress this enough. It emerged
yeah,
that somebody offered you a four-figure sum of money
yeah,
to turn up at their son's bar mitzvah.
This is true.
And you turned it down on the grounds that... I'm saying you were afraid people might find out.
There were many reasons why. I mean, I was confused, firstly, why on earth anybody would want me to be at their bar mitzvah, right?
Tim Lovejoy and James Richardson turned it down.
That's probably right. Would you have done it, Barry?
I wouldn't be asked.
No. Let's say, we could make it happen. Would you do it?
If it was guaranteed that nobody would find out, yes.
So, look, elsewhere in the Premier League, Crystal Palace go to Manchester City. They still haven't scored any goals. They probably won't score any there. Manchester United go to Southampton. Chelsea go to Stoke. Swansea, Watford.
I was writing down the list of fixtures. It's not a particularly inspiring week,
no,
which is not to say we won't have some good games.
It's true. Last weekend was boring, wasn't it?
Super Sunday, always a letdown, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the Sheffield Derby, though, is on Sunday as well. First one for 5 years. That could be a bit of fun. Also in the Championship, Bolton-Brentford, six-pointer at the bottom. Who wants to talk about Rio Ferdinand becoming a boxer?
Well, I have this theory...
Oh, I like your theories, Barry.
Again, like most of my theories, it could be completely harebrained, but I was thinking about this, and there's generally only one reason that fellas approaching their late 40s or in their early 40s who aren't very good at boxing getting the boxing ring, and that's because they need the money. And I'm just wondering, is Rio perhaps financially embarrassed? Because you'll remember that Kingsbridge Asset Management sort of scandal of a year or two ago. Loads of footballers lost the arse out of their trousers on these tax avoidance schemes and property deals, got big tax deals. The biggest investor in that scheme by a mile was Rio Ferdinand. Now, he's probably getting a nice whack from BT Sport, but he's also been paid by Betfair to do this and was bit touchy on when the subject was raised at the press conference he called to announce it. If he wants to be a boxer, grand, go and be a boxer. I don't know why he has to make such a song and dance about it, unless perhaps he is skint and needs the money. And there's a very good chance he's not skint at all. It's just something that crossed my mind, and it was surprising to me that no one else seems to have thought of that. But, good luck to him. I hope he doesn't do himself a mischief. I mean, Victoria Pendleton did a similar thing with...
horse racing.
Betfair when she went in the Fox Hunters Chase in at Cheltenham last year, and with a bit more training, she probably should have won it because she was on the best horse in the race, and it went on to win. She came with her time to run too late, but she did well just to get around in a race like that against very experienced jockeys. She was very handsomely paid for that. I reckon Rio's probably getting a lot more to do what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not totally unprecedented, is it? Football is becoming boxers. You look at Curtis Woodhouse, Leon McKenzie. I mean, obviously they were a bit younger when they started, but it's not completely uncharted territory.
My kind of favourite footballer post-retirement career shift was Barry van Aerle, who was at PSV in the 80s, and it was pretty like glorious career. It was one of five players to ever win a treble and the Euros in the same season, and he ended up becoming a postman after he retired. So maybe Rio should, or you know, may consider.
Neil Webb became a postman, didn't he?
So did Coventry's Mickey Ginn.
Oh, didn't Arjan Dazou become a private detective?
He did, didn't he?
Yeah.
I feel I've missed the moment to re-bring up Tim Visa's wrestling career now.
No, you can do it if you want. Hey, there's a story doing the rounds from Roy Keane's autobiography, which is not related to anything, but it's quite funny. I don't know if you've seen this. On the subject of when he was at Sunderland, thinking about buying Robbie Savage. Quote, I rang Mark Hughes. Robbie Savage wasn't in the Blackburn team, and I asked Mark if we could try to arrange a deal. Yeah, he's lost his way here a bit, but could still do a job for you. Robbie's legs were going a bit, but I thought he might come up to us at Sunderland with his long hair and give us a lift the way Yorkie had, a big personality in the dressing room. Sparky gave me permission to give him a call. So I got Robbie's mobile number and rang him. It went to voicemail. Hi, it's Robbie. What's up? Like the Budweiser ad. I never called him back. I thought, I can't be fucking signing that.
Despite the fact he admitted he was signing him for his hair.
Well, there
is quite a double standard.
Well, there's a line, and that's where the line is, clearly, for Roy Keane. Do you want some questions on the Twitter? Bear Jones, what's the worst game of football you've had to watch for work?
I don't know if it counts as work, but it's pretty undeniably anyone, take your pick, any one of the recent qualifiers that the Netherlands have played for the World Cup, for the Euros, just take your pick, any one of those, been terrible.
Crystal Palace v Bolton, I think on New Year's Day a few years ago when they were both in the Championship. It had been snowing the night before, no undersoil heating at Selhurst Park. I assumed it would be postponed. Went out on a massive tear-up. Didn't get in till about 6 in the morning. Hammered. Woke up, checked the Crystal Palace website. We are delighted to announce that blah, blah, blah. Dragged myself out of bed, went to the game, 0-0 draw, so cold, so horribly cold, and had to fill like 700 words of just nothing happening in with one of the worst hangovers I've ever had.
Andy?
Portugal versus Argentina, friendly at Old Trafford. Although on the plus side, producer Jonathan did buy me a half and half Ronaldo and Messi scarf.
Oh, that must be worth nothing now, I imagine. Some feedback corner we'll finish with. On the subject of a clone 11, 11 players who would be the best if they were all cloned and put on the pitch. Tim Pavey said, look no further than Irish legend Gary Breen, who had his own chant dedicated to just this concept. We all dream of a team of Gary Breens. On the subject of nice footballers, Jazz Horse would like to throw Tony Yeboah and Norberto Solano into the mix.
I was thinking about that, actually.
It was not nicest football, it's the most well-liked. So
yeah.
It's different.
Clan Mata. Hands down.
He was discussed last time.
Ian Wright.
Yeah.
May not always have been, but I think he is now. Kevin Caban, of course, we forgot. Mm. And Ugo Ehiog.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Would have
fallen
into that
I think going back to
bracket.
The Clone 11, I think Frank Rijkaard could have done a job pretty much at any position.
Yeah, but he's no Gary Breen, is he? on the subject of Crystal Palace players not remembering anything Roy Hodgson's done before the Iceland game because they're so young, Chloe Petter said, I'm 23, I remember pre-Iceland Hodgson. People born in the 90s did have consciousnesses in their teenage years. And Paul Slaney says, on the subject of all professional footballers being good at football, I mentioned Devon White as an example of someone who wasn't. Paul says, how dare you, Devon White not that good. You're never forgiven for that Devon White quote, angry face, angry face. He's a Bristol Rovers player. who we gave £100,000 to and took him and gave them John Taylor. And on that subject, 1234 says, can Max please stop talking about supporting Cambridge? We get it. He's a proper football fan and not a Glory supporter. It just seems desperate now. Max just shoehorns in the fact that he supports a lower league club at least three times each episode, and it always kills the conversation. It feels like he's trying to prove a point which no one cares about. And I'd got through until then before mentioning that I'm a big Cambridge fan. And thanks so much for your time, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Andy, brother.
Thank you.
Thanks, Priya.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back on Monday. Enjoy the football. Bye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.